Welcome to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoldotna. It's Wednesday morning, and of course, it's the day before Thanksgiving, and that will be what we're talking about largely on this week's episode of The Conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran, and happy this morning to be joined in the studio with a couple of folks from the local food scene, I guess is how we'll sort of characterize this. Lou Height is with us this morning from Eagle Glade Farms up in Nikiski. Good morning, Lou. Good to see you again.
Good morning, Shaylin. Good to be back here.
And we've also got Chef Ken Hines from the Flats Bistro is joining us this morning as well. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
So here's kind of what I wanted to have going on today. The thought is that we're continuously pushing for more local foods, not just in restaurants and in stores, but on our own tables as well, and in a lot of cases, first and foremost, on our own tables as well. So I wanted to spend some time because you two are most certainly in the know about what's out there, what's available, and especially this time of year when there's maybe not quite so much available as there are at other times of the year. But I did want to take some time and kind of talk a little bit about what's out there this time of year when, you know, it's not farmer's market season. It's, you know, it's kind of thin pickings out there, but I know that there are folks that do have things available, root vegetables and those sorts of things. So kind of wanted to start off with a little bit of what's out there, what's available, maybe how to get it. And then a little bit later on in the show, and hopefully for a good chunk of the show, I'm hoping to pick your brains about how to put those local ingredients to use as best we can. And then maybe just share some stories. What's good on the table at Thanksgiving with all the holiday cooking that I know that that folks have planned up in the coming weeks, and myself as well. And of course, if you have stories, if you have tips, if you have tricks, if you have questions about where to get stuff, how to use it, all those things, we'd love to have you in on the conversation as well. 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687. And so I guess, again, just kind of to get started, throw it out. Lou, would you like to kind of talk maybe a little bit about what this time of year, what is out there? What are folks able to have sort of on hand or for sale or those sorts of things?
Primarily root vegetables up here.
I'm having a hard time picking up your mic. Can we maybe switch that mic there a little bit?
Sure.
Oh,
is
that's
better.
That's a lot better.
That even sounds better to me.
There we go.
Okay. Locally available foods are going to be primarily root vegetables and storage vegetables. The few people who can successfully grow things like hard squash. And the best place to find out where to get them really is to get the Kenai Local Foods Directory that is available from the Soil and Water Conservation Service.
Yeah, great resource there.
It is a brilliant resource. And that for those that don't know about it, it is a directory of local farms that produce all kinds of good things, lots of leafy, fluffy stuff in this warm weather, but who usually also produce some root vegetables. Then there are a couple of retailers that also carry local produce. Everett's Acres up in Nikiski, which is a new outfit, carries potatoes, cabbage, garlic. Staying in Nikiski, call O'Brien's. O'Brien still has some apples, I believe. Locally grown apples and locally squeezed cider. What says Thanksgiving better than apple cider?
Right.
I agree with that.
Yeah. And there are others. I don't, you know, I'm not doing commercials for anybody. You know, they are two that I know of right off the bat where you can find good stuff. I believe Velma Biddick has some material as well, good things. And she's a brilliant, brilliant grower. If anybody can have stuff out of season, it's either she or Abiala at Ridgeway Farms would have things in their high tunnels that are a little bit surprising to find still available at this time of year.
Yeah. Yeah, and Ken, I know that you put a lot of focus at the restaurant on trying to source local stuff. How does that... Is it tough when you get into these leaner winter months? Or are you finding that that growers in the area are beginning to find ways to extend their seasons to meet that demand a little bit?
Well, it's always tough in the wintertime wherever you are, whether you're in Alaska or East or West Coast. You know, everything slows down. You're working off of people's root cellars or seasonal vegetables like hard squashes and potatoes, turnips, that type of thing. You know, there is a way that you can be creative as well too in the summertime to help you be able to utilize fresh vegetables in the wintertime, i.e. pickling, curing, fermenting, those types of things. So you can utilize what people have in the summertime and use them on your Thanksgiving or Christmas table. You know.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, of course, Thanksgiving is tomorrow. And so some of the things that we're going to talk about, you know, it's maybe it might be a little bit late for some of these things. But as long as we're kind of going in that direction, maybe what are some good ideas of how to use of how to put away stuff in the summer that would then be really good to use for holiday meal prep? Ken?
Nuts is a big one. You know, to be able to make your own peanut butter or to be able to can your own nuts is huge. Citrus is another big thing. You know, in the fall, you want to get a lot of citrus. You know, up here, we don't really get much fresh local citrus, but down in the lower 48, you know, in the fall is really when you want to capture that citrus.
Yeah, and also, you know, we're kind of at that time of year. You mentioned some apples available locally, but if you're really in the market for all sorts of different kinds of apples, this is kind of the time of year for that as well. And I know that in my previous life working in the grocery industry, there were people who like religiously every week would come in, all right, what do you have this week, what's available for different kinds of apples? And it's kind of like birding for some people. They want to try every variety of apple
that
there possibly is and just see what's out there, and it's so great that we have that opportunity to do that here, at least to some small degree.
Some of those apples are really, really delicious. The Norland, for instance, is a brilliant little apple. And Jim O'Brien usually has a bunch of those. I don't know if he's sold them all out yet. Other things that we can save in the summertime, we have a tradition up here of foraging. The berries, the berry pastes and berry jams, local leafy things like the local wild sorrel, which is every bit as good as French sorrel and a little bit more durable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know spruce tips is one of the really fast and easy ones that it doesn't take an advanced botany degree to be able to spot those and what's safe to eat.
And they're great in jellies as well.
Great in jelly and salsas, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, if you've got people coming in from out of town for the holidays or need to send some gifts out, if you've got some of that beautiful pink fireweed jelly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great idea. That's something, you know, a couple of weeks ago there was, and Lou, you were there. Ken, I don't think you had a chance to make it to there was a Farmers and Chefs Connection kind of a get together, kind of talking about wrapping up the 2017 season and this idea of how to bring local food purveyors of different stripes sort of up and down the food chain. How to bring them together and get everybody on the same team to sort of expand this whole thing and make a healthier market and a more stable market for everyone involved, and that means consumers as well. And I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts on sort of from both of you on how this local scene is sort of evolving a little bit and how those partnerships are evolving and is it growing? Is it really as bright of a future as everybody seems to think, or is there enough room for improvement that you kind of go, boy, I hope we can make it through and really do this?
Well, when you're starting from a base level of about 3,
it's easy to grow from there.
There's nowhere to go but up, right?
Yeah. The Kenai Peninsula is the fastest growing agricultural area in the state right now. And yet, Kenai farms tend to be very, very small. In fact, Alaska farms in general are small compared to the rest of the state.
Right.
I grow potatoes, and when I tell people that I had about a half an acre of potatoes, their eyes get big and say how huge. But where I came from on the East Coast, that doesn't even make a backyard garden.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we're using Lou and Steve's potatoes at the restaurant. We're going through them pretty decently now, and it's only November.
Well, and you know, for home consumers, you think about buying a 10-pound bag of potatoes, and for I imagine a lot of households that lasts a relatively decent amount of time. You're talking about the scale of a restaurant. 40, 50 pounds has gone. Like that.
Yeah. That's one round of mashed potatoes.
Yeah, that's a day of cooking. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and what we really need is to ramp up production.
Right.
Again, our farms are so small
mm-hmm.
that the mechanism that allows us to ramp up production. The mechanical diggers, the sorters, the mechanical washers and baggers are not here. There are a few individuals that have potato diggers, but they're one-row diggers. They're not, you know, I remember driving down the road in Delaware and seeing this 10-row digger dumping, right. filling a semi side dumper full of potatoes.
Yeah. And, well, it's interesting, too, though, because I think another thing that we're seeing, you can look to, and I'm going to be stumping myself on the gentleman's name, Tim, out in Bethel.
Tim Myers
out in Bethel. I mean, operations like that show, I think, sort of what the opportunity is to find new techniques and find new varieties of things that, that take advantage of what we do have to offer here instead of sort of fighting against what we don't have to offer in terms of being able to grow things.
Well, that's right. And Tim is a wonderful guy. He's very generous with advice and help. And in fact, I've never taken him up on it, but he once invited me up to come and see what he's doing. I've just been too busy to go. I said, we're starting from a base of about 3. He was starting from a base of about -3.
Right.
And, you know, when he started growing more than his family could eat, he stumbled into a wonderful opportunity in the Bethel area because mm-hmm. all there was barged in stuff and local forage.
Yeah.
And the local forage was very good, but the barged in stuff was, well, you know what it's like.
Right.
You know,
you open a bag of so-called fresh salad that's packed in argon. And
yeah.
The next morning it's compost.
Yeah.
It tastes like compost.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the foraging part and talking about some of the other things, sorrel and some other things. Ken, I know that you're kind of into that a lot too. Not just what can be grown locally, but what is native here locally. Those things are really important too. And I think sometimes maybe that gets lost in the shuffle. We get really excited about the idea of being able to grow so much here that we think of as sort of conventional items, carrots and broccoli and all these sorts of things. But what is still out here and has been here for thousands and thousands of years seems to maybe be getting, we're talking about spruce tips and those sorts of things. That seems to be getting a little bit more awareness, and people are more aware of what is out there and how to use it. And maybe is that something that you get that kind of vibe, Ken?
Oh yeah, tremendously.
Yeah.
You know, this area is also riddled with mushrooms.
Riddled with them. Yeah. We can't. There's so many of them.
Well, there's a lot of different varieties. Some are extremely dangerous to eat.
Right.
Obviously, some are not so dangerous to eat. And being able to decipher those two, I mean, that takes a little bit of care and a little bit of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that kind of goes back all the way into all of your food. If you take a little bit of more care and a little bit more knowledge, you know, you're going to have a better product. And if we so source locally, like our farmers out there that take a lot of care and a lot of attention to detail into these vegetables and everything else that they grow out there, fruits or what have you, I know that folks are doing honey as well too. It's locally,
right?
You know,
yeah,
it takes a lot of tender and care, and it shows all the way through. Instead of just going to the store, buying a packaged good, bringing it home, and not caring whether half of it gets thrown out or not, because you paid, you know, less of a price than you would at the farmer's market.
Yeah, that's the economics of it are really interesting because it's tough to compare. Honey is a fantastic example. You can go to a large retailer of some stripe and you can get honey for super cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, almost criminally cheap. Go to the farmer's market, it is considerably more expensive, but I guess I would be interested in hearing from you. What do you think the value is in that price difference? Because that's, I mean, you know, we live in a place where it's dollars and cents, man.
Right.
So if you're paying for something, you expect more value out of it. What do you get in terms of value out of that price differential?
The value for me is working directly with the folks who are working directly with either the bees or the vegetables, the land, the soil. You know, they're putting their hard-earned money that they take into something that is unknown. You know, you put it into the ground and hopefully, you know, you know enough to be able to produce it to make that back, but sometimes you don't. I mean, it's kind of a guessing game. So for me, I'm going to put my money and my faith in people that are putting their money and faith into themselves rather than a shipping company or a large freight company that's just going to ship everything that's grown by the thousands of pounds. And if they lose 2%, 5%, that doesn't matter, but if somebody who's growing on a smaller scale mm-hmm. loses 2 or 5%, that's a big hit.
Well, and I can tell you that I guess I don't know what the numbers are that are acceptable up here in Alaska, but in other parts of the country, acceptable numbers for what they call shrink, that percentage of product that is lost to degradation of some sort, damage or whatever, right. you know, that can be, depending on how big of a store you're talking about, that shrink, that acceptable number of shrink can be upwards of 15, 20% sometimes.
Right.
You know, you're talking about that massive amount of quality or amount of food to satisfy a demand for food that needs to be pretty. Here's something that leads me to a question for you, Lou. Do you find people to be particularly picky about their vegetables when they're buying from you? Because that's one of the things we hear about commercially grown produce in a store is, you know, one of the issues is that everybody expects these brilliant, bright, shiny examples of an apple or a lemon or a head of lettuce. And things in nature don't always look quite so pretty as they do. Do you find customers for your products looking aesthetically at things, or is that even a consideration?
Some do.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I do.
Yeah?
I think you should.
If something comes out really ugly, it stays home.
Or we get it at the restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I will sell deformed produce or, you know, a little bug damage here and there to people who I can trust to be able to use it well for a substantial discount. But, you know, I haven't had a beautiful potato since I dug them up. I keep those for myself because I know I can use them.
Yeah.
And that's where my shrink goes, onto my own table.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do try to look at what I put together and what I package from the eyes of a consumer. I mean, you know, I spent 40 years as a consumer before I ever started growing, and I know what consumers like.
Right. Yeah.
And I put a little bit of money into some nice packaging and some nice labeling, and it gives people confidence in what they're buying.
Yeah.
That also goes back to a lot of effort as well, too. It's not just the effort in growing. It's also the effort in marketing yourselves as well. You know, so you're not just marketing a brand. You're marketing yourselves. You're standing there. You're interacting with the farmers or the consumers, depending on who you are. You know, and that in turn gives them a little bit, you know, more, you know, just kind of a better situation to spend their money with you rather than somebody who's slapping on, you know, a sticker on a freight package and brings it up here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Ken Hines joining us this morning. He's the head chef at the Flats Bistro in Kenai. Lou Height with us as well from Eagle Glade Farms in Nikiski. We're talking about
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Kenai Conversation this morning here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, talking about local foods this morning, what's out there, what's available, how to put all those great things to use on your holiday tables this season. And joined this morning with Lou Height from Eagle Glade Farms and Chef Ken Hines from the Flats Bistro. And I got to tell you, this has been a fantastic show for me so far. It's a lot of fun to sit in here and watch two people talk about food and be really, really excited about it. It's just been great. We want to have you hop into the conversation as well. If you have maybe a favorite recipe that you would like to share, or if you have some tips and tricks and things that you've learned over the years that that you think could be of good use to other folks who are trying to navigate their way through feeding the masses this holiday season, we'd love to hear from you as well. 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687. And during the break, Ken, we were talking a little bit about KenaiLocalFood.org. If you're looking online for sort of a clearinghouse of what's out there and what's available, is a fantastic resource. KenaiLocalFood.org. But I know that there are other places that are kind of out and about right now that you can pick up a few things.
Yes. Right now, I believe Jeff Babbitt is going to be at Trustworthy. He has the Veggie Bus. So Jeff's been collecting vegetables from around the state, and he's been in Seward, he's been in Homer. He obviously has home base here in Kisilov, and he comes to Soldotna about twice a week. So he's got turnips, onions, garlic, kale, potatoes, kind of wintertime stuff.
Yeah.
But he's got them in abundance. And his bus is actually pretty rad.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to check that out yet. But again, this idea that I'm continually impressed at how we're kind of sneaking in just a little bit more all the time. There's a little bit more available and a few more people selling it, and a little bit later into the year, it seems to always just be inching forward.
Right. Well, availability is the biggest thing for me, especially in this area, is, you know, how to get it. You know, we can get it in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's really tough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a woman by the name of Kelsey Shields, wonderfully passionate woman. She owns Lucy's Market.
Muffins of the same name, I believe.
That is correct, yes. Formerly Totally Radish there, right by Fine Time, okay, in that same plaza. But she's starting to showcase local vegetables there at her stand as well. Yeah. You know, so, and you can find all sorts of goodies, and she's bringing in a lot of great cheeses as well too. Like, she's really passionate about cheese.
Yeah. There always seem to be this kind of thing where, if you were looking for a really good place to go out and eat on the peninsula, well, you'd on your way down, you'd fill up with gas in Kenai Soldotna and then head on down to Homer for something good to eat. But that really seems to be changing quickly. There are a lot more people not just selling and making good food, but a lot more people interested in it. And that seems to be, that's always the driving force. If folks aren't interested in local stuff done well, there's not going to be anyone there to supply that demand for it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the key, is being able to have that demand.
Right.
You know, is keeping people interested on the fact of buying more local vegetables. And right now, local is Alaska. You know, I'd like it to be the peninsula base, but, you know, that we're just not there yet.
Yeah. When you throw, I know that at the Flats, you like to play around with the menu a little bit. Do you get good responses when you throw stuff out there that's maybe a little bit off the norm from what people might expect here locally?
Good responses.
I'm sure you get a lot of feedback.
Yeah,
one way or the other.
We get feedback for sure. Yeah. But, you know, pushing the mark is the key.
Yeah.
You know, especially for the farmers, us in the restaurant industry, it's not being stagnant. It's not staying in the same place. It's being able to push the mark, to move forward, to find innovative ways to be able to get people produce, to be able to grow produce, to be able to, you know, push the mark on dishes and changing things and keeping people a little bit uncomfortable. You know, for me, I find comfort in the uncomfortable.
Well, that's
if that makes any sense.
It makes total sense, but do you necessarily want that with mashed taters and gravy?
No. I mean, things like that you don't mess with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But some classics are classics.
Right. No, but yeah, there's other things, you know, like sunchokes is a great way to expand on the potatoes. So
yeah,
instead
yeah.
of potatoes, you have a Jerusalem artichoke mm-hmm. that is mm-hmm. similar to you know, a potato. You know, so
yeah,
just kind of getting people more interested in different vegetables than the same old, you know, meat and potatoes.
Than the same old, yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to stay on that for a second because you mentioned there. I know that there are at least a few greens here and there available, and maybe even I don't know if I know that that herbs locally is something that there's a lot of interest in folks looking for some value added and dried herbs that are available locally, but. We talked about root vegetables and some different ways to think about doing up some root vegetables. What about getting the day started or getting a big meal started with a nice salad? I mean, how would you do something to dress up, you know, what's available? You know, all right, so we can get kale here locally and we can get some local carrots and how would you take that and make it a little more interesting and with a local spin?
Being able to utilize the vegetables in their own preparations, so to speak. So the carrots, maybe instead of pickling them, you marinate the carrots or, you know, something like that before you add them in the salad. Squash, you roast the squash before you put it in, and then roast the squash with something that's kind of a little bit flavorful. So like I said, curry powder or brown sugar or something that's going to kind of accentuate the sweetness in that. And then once you add those ingredients to the salad, it's not just greens and vegetables. Now it's greens and kind of beefed up, bumped up vegetables.
Yeah, you said marinate the carrots, which I'd never heard marinating vegetables before.
Right. Well, so you take a little bit of acidity and olive oil and, you know, pretty much anything you'd like. So the acidity helps break down the composition of the root vegetable because all the root vegetables are very tough.
Very tough and fibrous,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. So a little bit of acidity, whether it be lemon juice or orange juice, vinegar, you know, those types of things. Even tomato has a decent amount of acidity.
Yeah.
You want to do it for a long period of time with tomato. But if you're doing something like marinating, I usually do garlic and herbs and then a little bit of vinegar and some olive oil and just kind of toss them all together with salt and let them sit for a little bit before I add them to the salad.
I see a lot. You mentioning tomato is a little bit of acid and part of that process. I see a lot of things where roasting vegetables, especially where a little bit of tomato paste is added. That's not something that you would think off the top of your head would add necessarily something. It might muck it up, but apparently tomato paste does something interesting.
Well, tomato paste is great, or the tomato itself is great, because the longer you cook it, the more sweetness comes out of it. So
Okay.
You still have something that's very acidic like a tomato, but you cook it down for a long period of time and it turns sweet. So the tomato paste will add sweetness and acidity at the same time.
Yeah, and anything that you can do to cut out a little bit of sugar, not necessarily a bad thing.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Honey is also a wonderful substitute for sugars.
And something that definitely is available here locally.
Right.
Yeah,
we've got friends of mine at Wild Wilderness Farms, Robert and Renee, they mm-hmm. are doing honey and they are phenomenal.
Yeah.
We're working with Kelsey right now and to be able to showcase their produce
yeah.
there at Lucy's.
Yeah, great. Yeah, no, a number of folks that keep bees on the peninsula and have delectable honey for sale. And I had never, until I moved up here, had never bought just a raw honeycomb. Oh my goodness, you're missing out, bud. Yeah. Oh yeah, that was a life changer. That was an absolute life changer.
Okay.
But so we
Shailene, with honey, you can develop a palate the way you develop a palate for beer or wine.
That's what I hear. Yeah.
Oh yes, most definitely. Well,
and that has to do with how the bees are kept, I presume. Yeah.
And what flowers they're foraging.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like anything else.
Just,
it's
yeah.
what they eat. It's going to be able to tell you what they taste like.
Same principle as like grass-fed beef, I guess.
Kind of, yeah.
Maybe a little more delicate.
Yeah, yeah. I would have
you
to
know,
say.
If you want to start using some of the fancy French words, you get the terroir.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
The taste of the land, that's what that word kind of means
yeah.
in this translation.
Okay.
And, you know, a clover honey from here is not going to taste like a clover honey from a mass producer in North Dakota.
No.
And
more honey. Concentration of flavors.
Yeah.
And that's anything generally that I find locally is that you're going to have more concentration of the terroir, which or the land around you, than you would be if it's shipping. It's going to lose a lot of that nutrients and a lot of that freshness.
Yeah. And that's something that I'm hearing a lot of as we're talking about maybe different ways to put stuff together and think about preparing some of these dishes is I like adding layers of flavor. So instead of just chopping up vegetables and throwing them in with everything, roast them first to add a little flavor. And right. Yeah, just little things like that.
Well, I mean, to be able to get depth in your food, you have to have layers, right? For me, it's just like if you're, say, you know, we're in the holiday time, pie dough, okay? If you have layers of that butter and flour all together to make the pie dough, it's going to be crispier, it's going to be crunchier, it's going to be flakier. You know, if you just rip a pie dough, you know, one way and then bake it, it's going to taste kind of flat or just one note, you know? But it's like you take time, you take care, you take effort, you do it right, you'll have layers in your food.
Are you a pie baker, Lou?
Yeah, in fact, I love to make pies.
And so I have to presume you make your own crust then.
Oh, yes.
Is there a secret?
Love.
Ken's got it right. Love and, proportion of ingredients.
Yeah.
The proportion of the ingredients really matters, and it almost doesn't matter what the details of the ingredients are if the proportion is right. About 30% by volume of fat to a given volume of flour, and you learn the salt and the water that goes with it because no two bags of flour need the exact same amount of water.
Right.
Yeah, that's that thing about baking being sort of equal parts art and science, because there are so many variables. How the oven heats up and bakes is a variable.
Right.
And
where it is in the oven is also
bit,
you know.
On pie crust, something that I've heard, and I've never tried it, I've never used it before, I've heard a couple of splashes of vodka in a pie crust does something. Have you heard of this?
I haven't heard of that one.
I think that's for the baker.
Oh, okay.
Less for the pie dough.
Less for the pie dough. Okay. All right. I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah. We're not no yeast, and we're not doing anything risen today. I don't have time for it. Tune to the Kenai Conversation this morning on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, talking about local foods, some of the things that are available out there right now, how to put those things to use in your holiday meal plans. Happy to be joined this morning with Ken Hines from the Flats Bistro and Lou Height from Eagle Glade Farms up in Nikiski. And, you know, we've talked about a couple of different areas of meal planning, talked a little bit about how to pump up your salad game a bit, root vegetables. Wanted to get a little bit into the main course. Of course, you know, tomorrow is Turkey Day. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid growing up, and maybe this is the same for you two as well, there seemed to be one way to do a turkey, and that was to get up way too early in the morning, fret over it all morning, fret over it while it was in the oven, fret over it while you were carving it, and put it on the table and just cross your fingers and hope for the best. More and more, I see all sorts of different ways to take care of this turkey business, and more, it seems like more people are interested in doing as you were talking about earlier, that adding flavor thing. So whether that's brining it or whether that's preparing it in a wholly different way, maybe Ken, what are some ideas? What's like the hot new way to do up a full bird?
A hot new way to do up a full bird. Interesting. I don't know about a new way, but
because deep frying a turkey took the world by storm a few years ago, it seemed.
And the way you do that is to take a frozen turkey out of the freezer and then deep fry it in too hot of oil. No, I'm just kidding. Please don't do that.
That's bad advice.
That's the worst advice.
That's precisely do precisely the opposite of that, and you'll.
For me, if you're baking your turkey, brining is the way to go. I mean, that is it. Usually what I'll do is, for a recipe ratio, I'll do 1 cup to a gallon of salt. Okay. And then sugar and spice and everything nice. That's up to you. You know, I like to do lemon, sugar additives. You can use honey. I like to use honey because the granulated sugar, I find, when you bake it, it caramelizes too quickly. So sometimes you'll get a darker skin instead of that beautiful kind of super golden brown.
Yeah.
So the honey can be your substitute for that. So usually I'll do a cup of salt to a gallon of water, a couple of lemons, some fresh rosemary, and honey. So I'll probably do, if I was doing for the gallon of water, I would do probably about a half a cup of honey.
have a cup of honey, a cup of salt into a gallon of water with that turkey, and that's going to make a lot of difference.
Right. And, you know, you're going to probably need more than 1 gallon of water. So obviously you times the ratio by however much you need.
And with brining, in terms of how long you do that, there's like a point of diminishing returns where if you leave it in that brine too long,
yeah,
it's going to end up opposite of what you want. Brining
is going to break down the meat, and then you'll have just kind of soggy, soppy meat.
So for like a 12, 14-pound bird, what would you say would be a good amount of time to brine? And should it be done frozen? Should it thaw out in that brine?
I think it should, for me, it should be thawed out.
Thawed out first and then into the brine.
And then into the brine.
Yeah.
So what I usually do is I'll bring the brine up to a boil, and then so you can whisk and make sure everything's incorporated, and then I'll strain it or I'll pour it over ice. So the ice will cool it down. And you also have to think about the water content in the ice. So I'll do half ice, half brine, and then when you pour the hot brine in, it essentially turns into the full amount of brine that you need.
Okay.
So for a 12 to 14-pound bird, I would brine for no more than 3 days. No less than a day, no more than 3.
Interesting. So it is a considerable amount of time to really maximize that effort, yeah. Mm-hmm. Lou, do you have a favorite bird recipe or sort of main course recipe for holiday seasons?
I like a traditional old-fashioned turkey if I'm going to have turkey.
Yeah?
Okay. But one of the weird things that I learned a long, long time ago is if you can cook the turkey at least halfway breast down, you get much, much juicier breast. It can make it look funny with the lines from the rack. But if you don't cook it all the way to brown, then you can turn it over and put it on its back and kind of get rid of some of that. But, you know, that dry, sawdusty, sort of wallboard flavored turkey breast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's always the challenge because you think about a turkey and those drumsticks and those thighs are huge and there's so much connective tissue in there to break down and all those sorts of things. Yeah, turkey is tough, but it. Well, here's one of my. I'm going to share this one. This is my favorite turkey story, and if I've told it before, I apologize. But it's my favorite turkey story. It's called the Fairbanks Ditch Turkey. So I'm in Fairbanks and, kind of between things and times are a little bit tight, walking my dog and in the ditch there, it was good snow in Fairbanks that year. There's a lot of snow in the ditch. Dog makes a beeline into the ditch for, I don't know what was over there, but I followed her over there and she was digging up a whole frozen turkey. And yes, an entire frozen turkey in the package from Freddy's, like the whole bit. And you could tell that my guess was that it was one of those, you spend $200 at Fred Meyer's and you get a free turkey, or whatever. Right. My guess is it's one of those that was left on somebody's porch and a local critter took it somewhere else, decided it's frozen, I'm not going to do anything with this, got left in a ditch for some amount of time. Well, me being relatively a brave soul, I guess, I said, this is a perfectly good turkey. What a great opportunity to do a roulade, a rollout. So I went through, this is the only time that I found this acceptable to do this because it was a free turkey, to try to cut the carcass out, right?
Right.
And separate all the meat from all the bones. And then you have this nice, tight, rolled out package and stuffed with, that's the only time that I would stuff a bird was like this, with just a thin layer of stuffing over that nice flat thing, some caramelized onions, rolled it up real tight, tied it up with butcher's twine, and that was just a beautiful, beautiful turkey roast.
That's fancy.
That's fancy. Out of a Fairbanks ditch turkey? Oh, you can't beat that's the fancy. That's it. That's it.
That story went the other way than I thought you were going to
go. You thought that was going to end up badly, huh?
It was going to be weird.
It's a silver lining. It's making lemons out of lemonade.
Spatchcocking a turkey is also kind of interesting.
That's another new thing that I've seen a lot more of. Explain what spatchcocking is aside from a funny word.
Spatchcocking is not just used for turkey, but it's used for pretty much all
for
fowl.
All poultry. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So what you do is you cut out the backbone of the turkey and you press on the breast and the legs and kind of open it completely out. So it's laying completely flat, just like your roulade, like you said.
Yeah.
But you still have all the bones in it. So you have all of that juice and all the flavor from the bones as you're cooking it. So the way that I usually do it is I'll start with it down, and you have to have a large enough cooking vessel for this, right? So you can do it in the oven depending on the size of the bird. It's probably not going to work for a 20 to 25 pound bird.
Yeah.
You know, but
that's a lot of that. Yeah. That's a huge surface area when you lay that thing out flat.
Right. If you're doing a small bird, you know, at 12 pounds, it's not a big deal. You know, you could do something like that. You can even do that on the grill almost.
Yeah. And that's what I see it used for a lot. Because the whole principle seems to me to be that it cuts that cooking time way down.
Way down. Yeah. By hours. I mean, you could spatchcock a turkey at 12 to 15 pound bird and cook it in 2.5 hours, 3 hours.
And that's incredible when you think about how long it takes to do it kind of the traditional
low
way, sort
and
of.
Slow with basting and turning.
Yeah.
And, you know, it becomes an all day project.
It does. But I know for myself, I like that project. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the fun of it.
Right. Well, I raise edible pigeons that are called squab.
Interesting.
And that's a really good way to handle the pigeons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're tiny anyway. And actually, most of the time, the wings and legs aren't worth bothering.
Right. They're big-breasted birds.
Yeah.
You know, so, and the squab is absolutely delicious.
Is that something that you could turn around and, if you're just going to use the breast meat, could you use the rest for stock? Would it make a good stock?
Yeah. Most definitely.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I want to stick on that. Gravy. Well, what's the best way to go about making the challenge is that, you know, the bird that you want to use to make the stock to make the gravy is sort of in use throughout most of the day. So what would you do to make that kind of easier and do a good homemade gravy? How would you sort that out, Ken?
Well, the giblets and the neck are the way to go. So you make a stock with your giblets and
use those instead of the bones and all that kind of stuff?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, you can use last year's Thanksgiving turkey's bones, you know.
If you save those, yeah.
Generally, when you cook any fowl on the bone, you're taking all of the nutrients out of that bone. So when you do a stock with cooked bones, you're not really getting much.
Interesting.
Right.
Because that's the way you always hear it, is you're supposed to use what's left over for stock. That's
right. So if you're going to get a more fortified stock if you have fresh bones and you have cooked bones.
Okay.
I think all the flavor is coming out of the bones into the meat, flavoring the meat, and then you really don't have much left.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do it fresh, I would do giblets and a neck for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And then too, if you use a good roasting pan, you're going to have a lot of basically pot liquor.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of drippings.
The reduction in the drippings in the bottom.
Yeah.
Which you can dilute to a degree to make your gravy.
Yeah.
I like to do a gravy with a flour roux.
Yeah. Let's kind of go through that process, because making a good homemade gravy from scratch, it's not that difficult, but yet there's a multi-million dollar industry selling packaged and jarred gravies. So Lou, you mentioned like a classic flour-based roux. For roux is R-O-U-X, I believe.
Correct, yes.
French, very fancy French term.
Yes.
Maybe walk us through, how would you put this all together? So you've got sort of your liquids and your stock and your fat from the fowl, from the bird, and then how do you put that all together to drench over potatoes?
Well, generally, so the roux is butter and flour mixture that's cooked. So you want to be able to activate these starches in the flour, cooking it into the butter. So the butter needs to be hot enough, or the liquid, however, needs to be hot enough to incorporate the flour. So the flour and roux is almost equal parts. So you start in the beginning. Generally, what I'll start in the beginning is I'll sweat my vegetables and then in butter, and then I'll add a sprinkle of flour. So that flour kind of binds all together with the vegetable starches and with the butter. And then you'll get kind of a thick base.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll add your stock and you just keep whisking.
And it really is kind of just that simple.
It really is.
It is, and that's a good way to avoid getting lumps in your gravy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because if you just add the flour into the stock mixture, like Lou said, it's going to clump.
Yeah.
But if you add it in the beginning and just work it and whisk it in the beginning, it's going to incorporate all the way throughout.
And another, I know my dad sort of cheated when he would make gravy. He would take whatever the drippings were in the stock and then usually add a little bit of canned chicken stock or whatever. And then with a slurry, a little cornstarch and water.
Cornstarch and water, yeah.
And that thickens it up real quick. Same sort of process, but it doesn't take quite as long. And you lose the deliciousness of all that butter.
Right. Well, the great thing about cornstarch is that you can add it in at the end and thicken it however you want.
Yeah.
When you add the flour in the beginning, it's kind of a guessing game don't really know to be able to how thick it's going to be or how thin it's going to be. So if it's too thin, a little bit of cornstarch slurry can help thicken that up.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you do olive oil and flour together, that's my favorite.
Okay.
Instead of a cornstarch slurry, I use olive oil and flour.
Do you always?
That's the Italian in me.
Yeah, I was gonna. Okay, that answers my question. Is do you have like your ingredient grade olive oil and then your finishing olive oil?
Yes, definitely.
Do you?
Okay. Yeah. Usually when I cook, I use canola oil.
Yeah,
because it has a high smoke point
and not too much flavor. Doesn't really disrupt anything.
Exactly. Yeah. If I'm doing tomato sauce, I'll start with a lot of olive oil and kind of work it because it's going to impart flavor into the sauce.
But yeah.
If you don't want your oil to impart any flavor, because olive oil has a bitterness to it,
mm-hmm.
so that's why I use. Also, why I use canola oil.
Yeah.
It's a neutral oil and it's a high smoke point.
Yeah. We've got just a few minutes left here on the conversation this morning. We can't finish off talking about big holiday meals and all this. We talked a little bit about baking a pie earlier, but of course, I'm interested in what a good pie recipe is, because that's one thing that Alaska has so much of is pie ingredients out there.
Right.
Any number of different berries that if you haven't frozen them already, if you're not a berry picker, you can still find them in some fashion. But also rhubarb and things like that. I guess who's got the best like rhubarb pie recipe or the best locally sourced pie recipe?
Not me.
Not yet, anyway, right?
I have a wonderful young woman who bakes pies for me at the restaurant. So.
She's got all the tricks?
Yeah, she's got it.
Lou, you're a pie baker. What do you like to put together in a pie?
Oh, golly. rhubarb and almost anything.
Right. Rhubarb and why rhubarb?
Rhubarb has a really distinctive, strong flavor,
mm-hmm.
but it's not an overwhelming flavor.
Is it? Does it mellow out as you cook, or is
very
it?
Much
does
so.
It? Is
very
I,
much
I,
so.
I didn't know if maybe the baking process of a pie was delicate enough that it wouldn't change the flavor too much, but it is.
It can mellow it out very well, and you want that acidity of the rhubarb in almost any other pie.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, that's why you have the classic strawberry rhubarb pie. Because strawberries are too sweet that when you bake them into a pie, they become cloying.
Yeah.
I'll take almost any pie recipe and cut the sugar by at least a third.
Right.
That gives you a lot
more
flavor.
You can use that little bit of that third amount of sugar in the beginning. So generally like apples or rhubarb, I'll toss my cut apples or cut rhubarb in sugar and I'll let them sit and macerate for about 10-15 minutes.
Yes, and it brings out, to macerate, it kind of brings out the liquid a little bit
right.
and imparts a lot of sweetness.
Imparts the sweetness into it, something like rhubarb that has some bitterness and tartness to it. It accentuates that sweetness. It also helps in the cooking process as well, too, because you're pulling the liquid out. So sometimes when you bake an apple pie and it just becomes this, molten mush, instead of holding up nice forcefully, you'll have, adding sugar in the beginning will help.
That. Yeah. How do you keep the pie filling? You think about like a commercial canned pie filling and they're always so nice. They're always so really thick and they bake up and they hold their shape really well. But local berries or something like that might be kind of watery. How do you keep that nice and thick?
You cook them. What I like to do is I like to cook my pie dough or my pie filling first. So you cook it to the thickness that you need it to be, and then you add it in, you cool it down, and then add it into the pie.
Okay.
So instead of just adding all your fresh ingredients, because that moisture is going to pull out.
Okay. Yeah, kind of break down the process a little bit. Well, I'm looking at the clock, and my gosh, we've blown through appetizers and side dishes and main courses, and there's so much more I wish we could have gotten to this morning. But we did get to a lot of the local foods that are available, and again, real quickly.
One real quickie thing. If you want to give somebody a wonderful present, if it's somebody who does not like to cook, cook them a meal.
That is a great gift. Lou Hite, thank you for that tip. Thank you for being with us this morning. Ken Hines from the Flats Bistro, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Great to see you both as always. And again, KenaiLocalFood.org is a great place to go to see what is out there right now and what you can put to use during your holiday meal planning this season. Well, we hope you've enjoyed the conversation this morning. I'm Shaylin Cochran. Have a happy Thanksgiving and a great holiday weekend.